Hello and welcome back to Let the Stone Speak. I'm Brent Nuchtigall, the host of the program. Thanks for joining me today. I do want to mention that our exhibit, Kingdom of David and Solomon Discovered, here in Edmond, Oklahoma, is open for another couple of months, probably till early April. So if you're anywhere in the center of the United States, come and see about 46 artifacts from the time period of David and Solomon, an amazing exhibit. It's definitely worth your time. For today's program, I just got done interviewing Dr. Tali Erickson-Ginney. She's an archaeologist with the Israel Antiquities Authority, an expert of the Negev region in the south of Israel. She lives down there. She's lived down there for decades. She lives right now just on the border with Egypt. And she's going to talk about an amazing discovery that just was reported to the public this week of a 2,500-year-old tomb complex found with about 60 bodies in it. With all manner of artifacts that have a rich ritual function as well. And this is a period in the Bible that takes us from the end of Jeremiah's time through to the time period of about Ezra and Nehemiah. So an interesting window into this period about what was happening in the south of Israel is coming out of the discoveries from this excavation. So thank you very much to Dr. Tali Erickson-Ginney from the Antiquities Authority for this interview. Thank you very much for being on the show today. We're trying to get some good internet, so you're in your car right now. And so that's why it might be a little bit dark, but thanks very much for taking time out to speak with us.
You're welcome.
So what we're going to talk about today is an interesting new discovery that you've had a part in there in the Negev region. This dates to the time period, at least from what the reporting I've seen, around the middle of the first millennium BCE, around that time period. And it's really interesting because you've found what looks to be a tomb complex down there in the Negev. Perhaps you can give some details about this new discovery.
Well, I was saying earlier that I drive past this particular area daily for over 40 years. And I'm almost dumbfounded. I'm still dumbfounded that we came across such an unusual discovery. It's never been found in Israel. I live on the Egyptian border in a moshav called Kadesh Barnea, about 70 kilometers west of Beersheba. And so the tomb complex is located about halfway between where we live in Beersheba. So it would be south of Beersheba or southwest of Beersheba to some extent. It's located near a modern T junction. And that's very interesting because we know that the area that this tomb was constructed in was actually next to an ancient junction as well, probably a T junction, two very important roads of that time. Now, my colleague, Dr. Martin David Pasternak, is the excavator. He asked me to come out and check out the area when he started doing a salvage excavation, which he was doing on behalf of the Mikra Water Company. They were putting a new water line through. We didn't expect any big surprises. We know that there's a lot of early Bronze Age and Intermediate Bronze Age structures in that immediate area. The one structure that they pointed out was a little bit unusual because it was square. Mm-hmm. We don't have a lot of square buildings of that kind. Within a couple of days, he called me again and sent me a picture of part of a broken alabaster vessel. And he said, "We think that this is from the early Bronze Age." And I said, "Okay, you know, I couldn't see it that well." But the next day or so, when I came out to visit the site, I looked at it and I knew what it was. And it was not early Bronze Age. It was actually from the first millennium BC, much later in time, but much also very early, for about 2,500 years ago. It's an alabaster vessel that was produced in Yemen, in southern Arabia. And we have these in southern Israel. And I'm probably one of the only people that really knows to recognize them because we don't have them hardly anywhere else. We have them in a few places, mainly Nabataean sites, early Nabataean sites. And it was something that researchers over the years, when they did come across them, they didn't make the connection. They didn't know they were from Yemen. They assumed that they were locally made somehow, even though we don't have really good sources of alabaster, not in the Negev, maybe in the Jerusalem area, there's a source. Most alabaster is usually coming from Egypt. But it turns out that many years ago, It was a publication that was put out about this type of vessel in Yemen from southern Arabia. And they're called beehive shaped because they have a flat base, and they're very specific types of vessels. Like, they have features, they can be bigger or smaller. The alabaster can be kind of marbled, or it can be rather clear, but they always have certain the similar features that you can recognize. And this one was actually lacking the upper part, but I could tell just from the base I recognized it. Another thing that I also noticed, and I explained to him, was to something that I had not actually excavated myself, but I've been taught by people that came before me that worked the Negev, and that was part of the architecture in the inside of the this building that he was excavating. When I looked at the way one of the walls was constructed, I said, "Ah, this is something that's been seen here in the Persian period, Persian BC, from around between 500 400 BC,
right.
And the other excavators had found that. So that was where we started to understand that we had something else.
So this is really, really cool that, you know, the initial assumption is this is 2,000 years earlier, and then, or around that time, maybe 1,000 plus. And then it turns out a couple of interesting finds, architectural remains plus the alabaster vessel. You said you've been in the Negev region working for 30 years or so. So you're very familiar. Over 30 years. So you're very familiar about the other material finds in the area, and you from just the structure and the alabaster vessel, you could pretty much get the idea that we're thinking about the Persian period, which, at least from the Bible, Persian period means the period in which, under which, the during the time that the Jews went back to rebuild the temple, and that continued on through Zerubbabel, Ezra, Nehemiah's time, at least from the biblical standpoint, so that people are aware of the time frame.
Sure.
So did you participate in the excavation, or you're more of a consultant as you were coming
to
this?
I was a consultant, and we have a really good team of archaeologists in our Southern Regional Office of the Israel Antiquities Authority. And they, very quickly, I should mention that within a few hours after I was there and recognized the dating of the structure, we started finding skeletons, and we thought in the beginning, oh, there's probably one here, there's some kind of a burial here. This structure is about, the main structure is actually two structures, a bigger one and a smaller one. The bigger one is about 7 by 7 meters square, and it had two very heavy rectangular piers that were kind of columns, rectangular columns that were built from stone, from fieldstone, was inside this 7 by 7 meter building. It's not that big. It was taking up a lot. They were taking up a lot of room. And between the pillars, that was when Martin started to find the skeletons coming up, and he's seen a lot of finds. So our entire office, all the young people in our office, were mobilized to come out, and they started excavating. It was a great team. And they were sifting everything, and they were taking photographs. The documentation was just extraordinary. We had a few workmen, but most of the work was being carried out by archaeologists. And that was very important, because some of the finds that we've only recognized just recently, actually, were because we had young people, including a young prehistorian, Lauren Davis, who was working there, and recognize very tiny flint implements that we call microliths. And that was a very important discovery, as I'll go on to tell.
Yeah, so I think it's important that most people realize that when you do an excavation, Israel or otherwise, you might have an archaeologist directing it, and then perhaps another archaeologist or two students that are helping with the documentation. And then everyone doing the actual digging is a laborer, a day laborer, or somebody that, you know, is brought in to do this physical manual labor task. So the fact that you had a lot of professionals there, as you say, might be the reason why you had so many different discoveries being made. Can we just talk about the geography first a little bit more, going back to this location? You started to find bodies there in these two structures that were squarish shape from the Persian period. They have alabaster, and they've got some of these tiny little flint tools, flint elements, we'll say, for this point. But you said it was located at a junction along a major road today, but also anciently, right?
Well, the ancient there. Let's put it this: there were two ancient roads that met at this point. One of them is called, doesn't really have a name, but it's a track that we knew was already active in the early Bronze Age. That's connecting a major road from Egypt through the oasis of Kadesh Barnea, ancient Kadesh Barnea in Kudirat, and crossing the border. The western border and entering the Negev Highlands. And that track reaches over and eventually kind of turns towards the northeast, southeast, and going down through what we call the Big Crater or the Yeruchim Crater. It also has another name, Hatira Crater. And then down the Scorpion's Ascent. And the Scorpion's Ascent, anybody knows anything from the Hebrew Bible, Scorpion's Ascent, of course, was a very important landmark that appears already in the Old Testament and in several places. And so that was going down to the copper mines of Phaenon, okay? And we're talking about in the early Bronze Age, around probably early Bronze Age 1B period. The second road has a name, and it's actually was in use up until I call it a road, but it's more like a track, like a cam all these are like tracks, camel tracks. And the second one is called the Darb el Sultan. That is the Arabic name. In English, that would be the King's Way. Okay, we've heard of the King's Highway. Any royal or King's Way, basically, we're talking about a road that caravans were required to use because for tax purposes and for policing. That's why it's a royal road. And we actually know that there's records from over 2,000 years ago talking about in some places that you could get the death penalty for not going on the King's Road. Like they're trying to direct everybody over that. So the Darb el Sultan is this is a, another major road that's going down to Fainan, almost directly to the area of Fainan. In the early Bronze Age, you have copper mines there that are only about 15, 16 kilometers east of the modern border between Egypt and, sorry, between Israel and Jordan. So these are roads. They're not the only roads, but those are two major roads. And the tomb complex is placed exactly at this point where these roads meet. The reason that you have more than one road, I should mention, is because it took me a long time until I understood it, and I found some literature discussing Bedouins who had reported to researchers at the turn of the 20th century. They had told him Musil, Louis Musil, who was one of the big surveyors who came through the Negev, and they said, when we want to go down to the Arava Valley and to today would be modern day Jordan on the eastern side. When we're going down and we don't have anything on our camels, we go down the steeper pass, which the Darb el Sultan would be a steeper way to get down into the Wadi Araba, even though it's much more direct towards Fainan. But when we're fully loaded, we come up the northern way. They go up through the Scorpion's Ascent. So you have caravans that are going past this point. They're coming and going. They're coming back fully loaded from the east. They're coming on the northerly. It's a little bit li better. It's easier for the camels to go on.
So
Okay.
this road is going from the Araba Valley, and it's going to go eventually up to where you are, and then you could continue further towards Gaza, I suppose, on one of a different road.
Well, there's other roads too. There were other tracks. Yeah.
And but the originating point isn't necessarily Fainan; that's just connecting it. But you could actually travel further to the south,
Oh
correct?
yeah, obviously. Well, remember, I'm talking about the roads as they worked in the early Bronze Age. They were lined with very, very big road markers. They're rectangular structures that, for a long time, I was taught when I first started working in the Negev. They said they called them rectangular tumuli, as if they were built for graves. But after about 10 years or so, I had been driving around and roaming the Negev enough that I could see that these were actually had a very linear pattern. They were lining roads and tracks, and they're lining major ascents like the Scorpion's Ascent, going up to it, the Hatira Ascent, and places like that. So it was obvious that these were actually road markers. Now, these road markers are big and they're visible. They were built to be very visible on the landscape. And so all the other roads right up until the 20th century are still using parts or some of these tracks.
Amazing.
And so even the modern, even the modern road with the T-junction where it is that I drive past every day, it's they're basically all the roads, I would say, in the Negev and pretty much in most of the rest of the country as well, are going either on or next to a more ancient track. I mean, it just makes sense because these are going in, because of topography, it goes where it's easier to get through. In modern times, we can actually blast our way through hills, okay, and put a highway through, and we do that. But basically, the line is coming along pretty much parallel or even on top of the ancient way.
So you have these T junction, you have these ancient roads, and then right there at this crossroads, if you like, you start finding bodies in these two complexes. Yeah. So what does this talk about the function of what you found here, or what were some of the other artifacts that lead to the idea of what was taking place in this location?
Well, I should mention that the larger building, the larger tomb, 7 by 7 meter tomb. If Martin thought in the beginning that he just had maybe one or two skeletons, in the end he had close to 60 skeletons in this one space, and they were packed all the way through the structure, all the way around these two column piers that were upholding kind of some kind of a stone roof originally. And they were full of artifacts, and the excavators could see right away that there were women involved because they could see bracelets. And I mean, some of the skeletons, we have photographs of them actually with the bracelets still on the arms, on the bones of the skeletons. And but we started coming up with quite a lot of alabaster. Again, several of these kind of containers, which we know, and I talked about them earlier, I should mention that these were produced in southern Arabia, in the area of Yemen, to transport frankincense and myrrh.
Okay.
We don't know which. We can assume from what we found there that quite a lot of it was probably dried frankincense and myrrh are simply resin. They're tree resin,
right?
That's collected. And they harden. And then in order to use them as incense, you have to grind them up. And we found these grinders. We found mortars, and we found a mortar and pestle. And we found several of these jars and lids. The amount of alabaster that's coming from that part of the world was just amazing. And that wasn't the only kind of things. Another thing that we noticed, and we're still noticing as we work on the finds even now, that almost all of these things were broken.
Mm-hmm.
And we had incense burners. We had at least three or four incense burners. One was terracotta, a type, it's called a Mesopotamian type. Another one was basalt, very heavy. Another was sandstone, very heavy. They had all been purposely broken. And not only had they been broken, you could see the hammer marks where they broke them in half. I mean, these were heavy vessels. They had to work pretty hard to break them. They also broke the alabaster vessels. Like there was a tendency to break everything.
So what does that
if
mean?
You go looking, it well, if we go into ancient history, archaeology, we know that, for example, the goddess Hathor, the Egyptian goddess Hathor, that was part of her rituals, that they would break vessels. I guess they would make offerings and break. And I have to say one thing that I find very, very, as a very important note about what we discovered in this tomb, is that if you go to other sites, for example, Tel Lachish, you have a lot of these small limestone incense burners, but they're usually broken. You have them in pieces. They found dozens and dozens of pieces of them. Now we can say that they were probably broken ritually after use, because
okay,
that's
so
what we see in the site.
So they might use it once as an incense altar, and then after that's use, whether one or two times, they'll break it in situ and leave it
and
there.
Not just the altars, not just the incense altars, also the vessels that were carrying the incense resins, and even the mortars. They seem to be that they were making, they're preparing this resin for use to be burnt as incense. It was really amazing.
So do you get an idea that these people, that 60 people that you found there, is this a tomb once they already died, or they died sacrificially, or they were en route to somewhere and maybe a sickness happened or something? Like, what's the purpose of their death?
Now, I want to mention that there's a second smaller tomb that has only one column or pier upholding what would have upheld a ceiling. There we had another seven individuals, but we also had, again, the alabaster and the mortars, and that we found there the ceramic or the terracotta Mesopotamian type incense burner and that part. As for what happened, the excavators noticed. They were very good. They were taking photographs constantly. They were drawing everything in. They could see that some of the skeletons had been pushed aside, or bodies had been pushed aside to put in more. So we can assume from that, and also from the finds, that the tomb was occasionally opened up and more bodies were placed inside of it. Now, we talk about the Persian period, but we also have earlier. So it seems like the structure was probably originally built sometime at the very end of the first temple period. That would be the Iron Age 3 period, something like that. See? And it would be sometime before the Babylonian invasion, destruction of Jerusalem. And it continued to be used right past that into the Persian period.
So this site is constructed sometime perhaps around the 6th century or end of the 7th century, somewhere in there. And then
Yeah,
it's
we
got
think so.
multiple times you've got more bodies being put in it through the Persian period, and there's no settlements around. So these are people that
No,
are
and no fortresses, and no
no
fortresses
fortresses.
either.
So these are
Yeah.
people that are in a traveling party, I assume, that are going
Exactly.
through this region. And do they die on the way and then they put them away? Or I guess we don't really know.
We don't really know. I can tell you that we had another grave that was discovered not too far away, also off the track of the Darb el-Sultan, the site called Ein Zik. And there researchers found, this has been over 40 years ago, 50, over 45 years ago or so, they found a mass grave of men, women, and children. I think over 20 individuals or more. And that looked like they had been raided and all massacred. But here we don't see that.
Okay.
It doesn't seem to be the picture.
So this is pretty interesting because you do have, I think in the Bible, you've got several references to definitely trade coming up from the area of southern Arabia, area of Yemen. They're bringing up spices, like you say. It's mentioned in the book of Jeremiah. It's mentioned in the book of Ezekiel as well. And then even in the book of Nehemiah, you have this increasing mention of Ashdodites, like this focus in Nehemiah of this power base that was from the Gaza, but then also perhaps further to the south as well. He mentions this governor Geshem or Gashmu, perhaps that
Gashmo,
is
yeah.
Gashmu that is working in this area. So this is the time frame of when these caravans were traveling up, I suppose. Is there
Well,
any more?
we're
Go ahead.
talking about a time period when the what we know from historical and archaeological sources, that this area, all of northern Arabia, all of the Negev and Sinai, is being controlled by the Kedarites.
So, do you feel like these were like middlemen that were operating through the trade of these through here?
That seems to be the case. We have so much material from southern Yemen or southern Arabia that it almost looks for sure that there were actual, yeah, I would call them Yemenite, or maybe from the area of Maan or Sheba. We talk about the Queen of Sheba. Of course, that's the same area that she's coming from, but earlier in time, about 500 years earlier, 400 or 500 years earlier. But we're talking about traders that are coming through there. The ones that are in control of the roads are the Kedarites, and their control extends right up to almost to the Nile, right up to the Nile Delta. And they've actually found sites with that. I've given presentations that I called it, talking about the tombs. I called it before the Negev, before the Nabataeans. We talk about the Nabataean incense
Absolutely.
road. Well, this was part of the incense road before the Nabataeans. The question is, what happened? Like, where did the Nabataeans show up all of a sudden? And there's a very good researcher who works in Petra, Robert Winning from Germany, who's actually proposed, and I think it's a very good, solid proposal, that The Kedarites around around 380 BC, 385 BC, had joined a revolt together with the king of Salamis in Cyprus against the Persian Empire. And from that point, suddenly we're not hearing about the Kedarites.
Right.
So it appears that the Kedarites had their trade rights taken away from them by their imperial masters. And this is given to the Nabataeans. So suddenly the Nabataeans are the ones that are in control, and not the Kedarites. But they're very closely connected, by the way. The Kedarites and the Nabataeans are coming from the northern Negev, but they're trading, and they're bringing incense and exotic goods from southern Arabia and from all the way, and also picking up things as well from ports and bringing it into the Mediterranean basin into Egypt.
Why these largely females, young females, have been buried here. I read that you might think that they are actually coming up to be part of the trade themselves, being traded.
Yeah. Well, we could tell just from the finds that there were a lot of women involved. And we recently got our anthropology report, at least a preliminary report, points to two groups of people there. One group is made up of young women between 14 and 20 years old, and the other group are men aged 30 to 40 years old. And it's very intriguing. There's no children, there's no babies. I had already proposed before, and I think that the findings are supporting that the women that they were found, these young women, might have been actually traded or bought. And the reason I said that is because we have from the 3rd century BC, down in Yemen, many, many years ago, there was an inscription that was discovered that talked about buying women that were bought and brought to that place in Yemen. 30 of them, the biggest group of them, were coming from Gaza. Well, we're not that far away from
That's right.
Gaza,
This
this
is, yep.
tomb. Then, yeah, I mean, really not maybe, what, 40, 45 kilometers away or so.
Right.
And then we have other women. They're also from, the list mentions an Egyptian, a Greek woman, women from Moab, Ammon, Edomites. It doesn't mention any women from Judea, but of course from Judah, but of course this is after the end of the kingdom of Judah. We're talking about under Persian administration and later.
You have some inscriptions that were found in southern Arabia that detail a trafficking of women from Gaza and other places down to that area. And what you're describing is the roadway that we're on where this was found. It would be on the path, if that's correct.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It's a major junction, and there seems to have been symbolic and cultic significance to that being chosen to have a crossroads burial. There's in ancient times, and there's also one of the ideas that was put forward many years ago about the women that are listed in the list found in Yemen is that they were bought as to be temple prostitutes in the temple in Ma'an in Yemen, what would be Yemen today, based on the Mesopotamian type, like you'd have in Babylon, which is spoken about by Herodotus in the 5th century, around that time. We also have other records where the women are being bought and to be sold as temple prostitutes. And that's an important point because some of the finds that we discovered in the tomb actually seem to have some kind of significance. For example, we found very, very large cowrie shells. We have cowrie shells all through ancient history and prehistory, on the small ones. We have them as jewelry. But in this tomb, they found near around 10 very large ones, as big as your fist. And the only time we've been seeing these kind of very large cowrie shells has been in temples of female deities, for example, in Petra in the Temple of the Winged Lions, and in another temple that was discovered from the Roman period down on the eastern desert of Egypt along the Red Sea coast. So here we have them too. And again, there were a lot of trinkets as well. There were a lot of things we have. There were scarabs. Some of them were Phoenician type scarabs. There were a few very, very small number of ceramic vessels, and the ones that were there were very small and portable. One of the earliest ones we have is a cooking pot with an impression, a seal impression that had been impressed into the handle, which is found right at the end of the First Temple period, before the destruction of the Temple in Jerusalem. It's a Judean type. And I have to report a brand new discovery that we're still looking into. We have to get better photos. We want to try to do it maybe using AI. We just discovered among the things that we knew that there were scales. There were small bronze or copper scales that were used probably. And not only scales, but also weights. And one of the weights is a Judean type. And just yesterday, we discovered that we actually have Paleo Hebrew written on it.
No way.
We couldn't see it quite before. Yeah, it's scratched onto it. And we're consulting with experts on it. And we're going to look into that. And we're going to try to get some better photographs to be able to make out, to see what, with all this new system, there's new technology with AI that we can actually get a better idea of what it says. So that was something that we keep finding new discoveries just from this excavation. Even 2 years later, we're just going through the finds and discovering things. It's fantastic.
Well, I just attended this ivory comb exhibit that was found at Lachish. They had a presentation in Eastern Tennessee. And the way that Madeline Mumshoglu found that was she just brought it out, this comb, in the process of documenting a comb. And then she, wait a second, there's writing on this. And so some of the greatest discoveries are found in the lab far after the excavation has taken place. So, well, anyway, we look forward to that. Any type of inscription, especially found in a place that like this, that might give some indication as to what was going on there, would be certainly valuable. So these discoveries you're talking about, are they on their way to being exhibited, or how are people going to be able to see some of the things that have been discovered here?
Well, Martin and other researchers have been working on preparing it for publication. We still have work to do. We have some very good researchers that have been doing, for example, Dr. Amir Golani, who's an expert on ancient jewelry.
Right.
We had many, many beads, carnelian beads and different kinds of things, fibulae. One fibula I should mention was called a spectacle fibula. It has spirals on it. And what's really interesting is that is found, it was produced in Southern Europe and brought to the site. And in Southern Europe, when they've been finding this particular type of fibula in the burials of women, again, we have one of the latest things that we have in the tomb is an eye pendant, which was produced somewhere in a Phoenician place. It's glass. It's a glass eye pendant, probably in the Western Mediterranean. It was brought from very far away. And then, like I said, we have quite a few things that are Egyptian in origin, a little faience vest figure, that kind of thing.
So if I'm understanding you, just the trade route through here, if you wanted to get somewhere from the Western Mediterranean, from Greece or Phoenicia, I mean, these places, they're going to be kind of funneled through Gaza or this area of the what we would call the Philistine coast today. And then their journey south, if they're going to take a journey down to Arabia, it would be going through and past this road. Is that correct? Is that why you have this kind of hub?
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's a couple other ways you could go, but this was the more normal way. It's going basically down into the Arva through what we call Edom of that time. Mm-hmm. And from Edom, what's Edom? Petra, the incense road, pretty much the same roads that are going through Northern Arabia and down to Southern Arabia, right along that, in the same, pretty much the same roads, I would say.
So this is a lucrative roadway.
Absolutely.
So to actually find what you've got, I mean, people might think it's a bit of a waste in a tomb. Obviously, you find lots of important things in tombs, but since this was repeatedly people were put in there, and then you've got this array of really really rich discoveries. I think it speaks to the mercantile nature or the trade route that it's on.
Absolutely, especially the scales that we didn't know that there were scales until they came out of our labs, our metal labs, and then we discovered. I'd already seen that there were a set of weights, and then we put the two and two together, and then you know as it goes on. But I also should mention that the women that were buried, they had jewelry, but there's no gold. We didn't find any gold jewelry. We found a couple of pairs of silver earrings, But there were bracelets. They were mostly made from copper. So it, they had a lot of trinkets, a lot of trinkets, a lot of beads and polished stones and that kind of thing. But it reminded me there's a quote with Homer. We're talking about the shifty-eyed Phoenicians and selling all their trinkets. The women coming up to the ships, the Phoenicians would show up and they would come to the ships to buy all their trinkets. And we found tombs full of these kind of trinkets like that. We found, like I said, we had one little bust figurine made from faiences from Egypt. We had parts of things that were even earlier in time that were probably used as charms or something like that that were buried there. And as I talk to you, I'll remember more and more. There was a mirror. There was part of a mirror that was found there, a copper mirror, something a woman would have, you know. And now I have to say something else. What I think is really amazing, one of the newer discoveries that's come up in the last half year were the microliths that I mentioned earlier. The microliths, when they started to be studied, when we have
So can you
microliths, we
just
usually think of much earlier spirit.
can you explain? That's a really technical term. Can you explain that, what that is for us?
Okay, a microlith, if I could show it to you, I was just looking at them today. They look like almost little flakes. And these are, we call them arrowheads, but they're not the kind of arrowhead that has a point at the end. They're kind of blunt on one side. These would have been fixed to an arrow, to a shaft of an arrow. And they would probably have some kind of poison or something on it to maybe knock out or to slow down, like rabbits or small game, that kind of thing. Now, there were over 40 of these tiny, tiny flint arrow. We call them arrowheads, but again, they don't look like the kind of arrowheads that we would think of, like an Indian arrowhead. They're very well known from prehistoric times, but to find them in a tomb sealed all together in one place, it was strange. And when our expert, Dr. Jacob Vardy, started going through them, the one place he called us, he said, "There's something going on with this. There's something strange here." The only place I know that I can find that these would have been from in this time period is from Yemen. And we said, "Well, we know that. We already have all these
So
other things from
he was
Yemen."
kind of separate from
So,
it. He didn't really
yeah,
know. He didn't.
he was not in the original excavation. He was working independently. I mean, we had we, he was working on these. Not only that, a few of them actually had red ochre that were on the arrowheads. One of the arrowheads was actually from quartz. That's interesting because, according to our researchers, Lauren Davis actually had mentioned this to me earlier, that in Africa they don't have flint, so they're making these kind of arrows and out of arrowheads. They're not arrowheads, but the microliths are being produced from quartz. And in fact, later when I started going through the stone finds, which I'm writing up, I found a whole core of clear, crystal clear quartz. And when we showed it to Dr. Vardy, it turns out it was used for making microliths. It was
No
just
way.
amazing. And it doesn't come from Israel. It had to have come from quite far away, probably somewhere in Africa, maybe Madagascar, something like that. We're looking into it, but we might never know. But what I find very interesting is, why would you have these kind of implements? Because Kobe could see, Dr. Jacob Vardy could see that they were not used. They were made by one person, very skilled. Had to be very skilled to make them. Somebody who knew that what they were doing. They were all very uniform, and there's over 40 of them. But I raise the possibility that they were used for divination, what's called belomancy in ancient times. And we have in the Book of Ezekiel in the Hebrew Bible a statement which I had already used about the tombs. It talks about the king of Babylon going, standing at the crossroads. The word, by the way, in Hebrew is interesting. It doesn't say crossroads. It says Em HaDerech, the mother of the road. That's the way
Oh,
mother. And
interesting.
again, and we have these women that are buried at a crossroads at Em HaDerech. And he stands there and he reads the liver and he shakes the arrows. And
Interesting.
where else do we have arrows used for divination? In the Kaaba. At the time that Muhammad takes over the Kaaba in Mecca, one of the things they find are arrows or arrowheads. If you look into the Arabic word for arrow, in this way, in Hebrew, it would say chetz, but in Arabic, it would be like chez. It also means luck. And of course, luck is something you would have for divination that people are using. So So I think that we have a very strong case for seeing these artifacts as something to do with divination. And when we go to Yemen, and this is what Dr. Vardy discovered, is where are we finding these in Yemen? We're finding them in tombs, and we're finding them in temple sites. And here we have them here in the Negev, in this particular tomb. It's an amazing discovery.
Absolutely. It is. It's you could consider being down there in the Negev as this place that might be barren. Well, it is barren, but not
it is
but
barren, yeah.
But lacking a lot of excitement. However, in terms of archaeology, this was just an amazing discovery that was found with such rich variety of wares and that came from all over the world, it seems, coming through here. Well, thank you very much for taking your time. Do you have anything else to
You're
add?
Welcome.
Or we can...
I know I have more to add. We had so many finds, and later I'll probably think of other things, but those are some of the most the big highlights. And it's kind of the gift that keeps on giving. We keep finding... Even in the last 48 hours, we're finding new things, that important things to report.
Well, thank you very much, Tali. We might have to have a follow-up conversation with you going forward. Previously, we spoke to you about King David's time. Now we're jumping forward 500 years. We really like the work that you've been doing, and your breadth of knowledge is very helpful to us. Since you've been down there for so long, you've got a great awareness of how all the other pictures can interplay with new discoveries. So thank you very much for your time.
I had the best teachers, I have to say. I really did. In the Israel Antiquities Authority.
You're humble as well, so that's good. That's a bonus. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Brett.
Thanks for watching the program today. I did want to mention once again our exhibit here in Edmond, Oklahoma, Kingdom of David and Solomon Discovered. Please come and see us. I'm right here. I'll be happy to talk to you, and one of our guides or myself will be able to take you through this archaeological exhibit as well. We're open until April 10th. I'd also want to mention our magazine that we put out every 2 months. This is absolutely free. It's called Let the Stone Speak. You can simply, and it covers topics, biblical archaeology, biblical history, and it's available to you wherever you are in the world. You can simply go to our website, armstronginstitute.org, and you'll find a spot on the front page where you can sign up. Or you can write an email to letters@armstronginstitute.org, simply put in your name and address, and I'll make sure you get a copy.